Support for the Marketplace Money podcast provided by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, providing the financial expertise that helps both our members and our communities thrive. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com.
Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland. How often have you heard the term middle class and thought to yourself, what does that mean? Well, we went around the country asking self-described members of the middle class for their definition.
The average person, someone that makes, an income of about $50,000 to $70,000 a year.
I am part of the middle class, but it's harder to be in the middle class in New York because the middle class here seems to be priced out, especially in housing.
Someone who's able to at least pay their bills every month and have a little money left over, be able to appreciate things that are finer quality like art and music.
So how do you define middle class? How do economists and politicians think about it? And how does all of this affect the way we work and live? Those questions and some enlightening answers coming up on a middle class edition of Marketplace Money from American Public Media. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. We know a little something about you, dear listener. Most of you are college educated. You earn a decent living. But judging from the calls and emails we get from you, you are also very worried about having enough money to retire, to help put your kids through school, sometimes even to pay the credit card bills and the mortgage. You know what that makes you? The vaunted middle class. At least, that's one definition. I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
Raise your hand if you think you're in the middle class. I can't see you, but I'm pretty sure lots of hands went up. You probably characterize your family as not rich, not poor. Politicians love you. In fact, you could argue the middle class is one massive special interest group. But who are you, really? We'll spend this entire special hour of Marketplace Money examining that question. We open with Marketplace's Steve Tripley. He profiles three Marketplace listeners' households where the occupants are convinced that they are middle class, capital M, capital C.
Judy Dunn defines being middle class simply.
It means, to me, you have some choices in your life.
And her family has choices. She lives with her husband and two daughters in Acton, Massachusetts, a comfortable Boston suburb known for its good schools. Living there was a costly choice, but at least one they could make. Good schools matter to them. And Judy, who's an artist, got to make another choice.
So I do all this decorative work on the surface of the clay.
She's launching a home-based crafts business that isn't earning much right now, but does let her be with the kids. The Dunn's household income approaches $150,000, but Judy says they're just middle class, partly because of what it takes to live in a very pricey region. Her way of putting it is that middle class status can't be judged on income without context. And the costs of raising kids and keeping up even a modest home in her pricey town are real. So Judy says the Dunns have to make plenty of choices.
The windows are drafty, and so we replaced half the windows because that was what we could afford. And we do that at the trade-off of saying, okay, do we have a cushion of savings so that no matter what happens, we're okay?
They save regularly, but Judy says it's not enough for either retirement or college costs. She's hoping her business will take off or they'll find some other way to meet those needs down the road. Now let's move 1 hour and one state to the north.
I feel like middle class is you have housing, you have shelter, you have clothes on your back, and you have food in your stomach.
Matt and Sarah Cost are living much closer to the line.
We have all three of those things and pretty much nothing more.
They're in their late 20s, college educated and working full time in the arts world. In New Hampshire, as elsewhere, arts professions are a long way from Wall Street money, $36,000 a year combined. Matt Cost says with a sigh that they're middle class but poor.
We never can't make the rent. We never can't eat. But at the end of every month, it's sort of down to the last penny on those things.
Almost literally the last penny. They keep a handwritten budget that includes rent, student loan, and car payments, and even quarters for the laundromat. They don't have cable TV and almost never go out to eat. But by the end of the month, Sarah Koss says spending choices still get excruciating.
Even renting a movie, you know, which is just like $2.99, but I mean, sometimes it's so tight, we're like, oh God, can we really spend this $3? And then you're not relaxed anyway because you're stressing about $3. Like, that's so terrible.
But they're optimists. Time is on their side, and they have health insurance, even though it's costly. But going forward, they know they either have to move up in their professions or find another way. Back to suburban Boston, where just before Christmas, I sat down in a busy coffee house with 30-year-old Elaine Kornbaugh from the town of Waltham. Here's her middle-class story.
I'm getting by, but I'm not getting ahead.
Kornbaugh's startup costs for adult life are blocking her way forward. She's got graduate school bills plus credit card debt from living expenses when she first left school. She makes $55,000 a year as an editor now, but has two side jobs to stay afloat. She admits to small luxuries like dining out, but that's not getting her debt down, and she knows it.
At some point, I'm going to have to make the decision to either take out another loan to pay it down or get on a very strict budget, and I think I need to do that sooner rather than later.
In the meantime, nothing, like sickness or a layoff, can go wrong. Kornbaugh feels she's working too hard, and if she kicks it up another notch to pay those debts, she can't see how she'll get beyond that.
I don't know how anybody can ever afford to have kids. I don't know how anybody can afford to buy a house.
Her plan is to try working her way up while keeping an eye out for new opportunities. So from where they sit, Judy Dunn, Matt Kost, and Elaine Kornbaugh don't like the middle class's position these days.
There's no breathing space. There is absolutely no breathing space.
My sense is that it's kind of going downhill.
I honestly don't know how people get by, and I figure that it must be what I've experienced so far, is that you end up getting in debt. It's like the brand new kind of indentured servitude.
You get the sense that they and other listeners who wrote us walk a tightrope. They mention housing, health care, and education bills weighing them down and hindering efforts to save for the future, which in turn leaves them vulnerable to other setbacks. And they say their parents had an easier time achieving middle-class security. I'm Steve Tripoli for Marketplace Money.
I'm a middle-class man, doing the best I can. Somebody help me.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thriven Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
So, is there a hard and fast number to define the middle class? United States government, you want to help us out here? No? Not really? Well, at least there's an official poverty line. In 2007, it was an annual income under $20,650 for a family of four. As for middle class, well, the Congressional Research Service issued a report last year pegging middle class income as between $19,000 a year and $91,000 a year. But even the specialist in quantitative economics who put together that study said there is no consensus or official government definition. So we decided to ask around. First up, Brookings Institution economist Gary Bertless.
You don't need to show a passport or a baptism certificate or a club ID to be admitted to this group. If you say you're a member, then I think you're in the middle class.
He uses the term middle income rather than middle class, and he bases his definition on the median household income, which last year was $48,200. Bertless says the middle can range from half of that to twice that number, so $24,000 to $96,000. But in surveys, people and families far outside that range will say they are middle class. Bertless says that's just American egalitarianism at work.
So people who have very high incomes may not want to claim a superior position. Similarly, people who have very modest incomes do not want to accept any indication that they have second-class status in our society.
MIT economist Frank Levy came up with a definition based on census data for families in their prime earning years.
I would say a reasonable range is about the $30,000 to $90,000. Most of what we mean by middle class, I think, is how easy is it for you to afford the basic building blocks of a good life in America, and that means, can you afford a single-family house, and can you afford a car, and can you afford to heat the house, and so on and so forth.
And finally, we hit the campaign trail to find out how this year's presidential candidates are trying to attract the middle class. Here's how Republican Mike Huckabee is drawing the line in a current TV ad.
I believe most Americans want their next president to remind them of the guy they work with, not the guy who laid them off.
Huckabee isn't the only candidate wooing the middle class. John Edwards is well known for his Two Americas theme. Republicans like John McCain and Rudy Giuliani say their tax cut proposals will help the middle class. And Hillary Clinton promised not to raise taxes on those making above $97,500 just to save Social Security.
I do not want to fix the problems of Social Security on the backs of middle class families and seniors.
In a recent debate, Barack Obama took issue with that figure.
Understand that only 6% of Americans make more than $97,000 a year. So 6% is not the middle class. It's the upper class.
And Clinton's response?
It is absolutely the case that there are people who would find that burdensome. I represent firefighters. I represent school supervisors. I'm not talking, it's different parts of the country.
Exactly. Go to Bankrate.com's cost of living calculator and try to compare two major cities. Living a nice life on $90,000 in Atlanta? You'll need $147,000 here in Los Angeles for a similar life. Ugh. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. One of the biggest costs facing middle-class families? College education for the kids. All the 529 plans, scholarships, and grants aren't likely to pay the whole bill these days, so you've got to rely on loans. But they may get harder to come by. Sallie Mae, the nation's largest student lender, says it's going to be more selective about who it lends to and what kind of loans it hands out. That cannot be good news for middle-class high school seniors. Mark Kantrowitz is the president of the financial aid website FinAid.org. And Mark, why the cutbacks at Sallie Mae?
There are two main reasons. The subprime credit crisis has led to higher costs for these lenders and also made it more difficult for them to get funding to issue loans. Congress has also passed legislation that's cut the profits from the other end, so they are seeing their profit margins squeezed significantly.
So what does this mean for students who are hoping to take out a loan and go to college? Is it really going to get that much tougher?
It'll get a little bit more difficult. For consolidation loans, I expect minimum balances to increase from the current low of $5,000 to about $10,000. Private student loans are going to become more selective as lenders tighten their credit underwriting criteria.
Now, what does that mean? Does that mean, for example, that as a student or a parent, you will have to have a higher credit score?
A slightly higher credit score. And previously, you could have a credit score as low as 620. Now you have to have 650. They're also going to require more co-signing of loans. So if you're a student who doesn't have much of a credit history on your own, you might find that your parents have to co-sign the loans. Federal loans don't require any kind of a co-signer.
So what does this mean in general for a middle-class student who is counting on being able to get, loans to pay for college?
They'll find it a little bit more difficult to get private student loans, but they'll still be able to get federal student loans. Overall, slight increase in costs, slight decrease in loan discounts. But generally speaking, the nonprofit lenders, which are state agencies, offer the lowest loan discounts. And if you want to reduce the cost of your loans, look to the nonprofit state loan agencies as the source of low-cost loans.
Don't we, though, also anyway try to encourage students to do whatever they can to avoid the loans in the first place?
Absolutely. And if you have to have debt, focus first on the federal loans before resorting to private student loans, because the federal loans are cheaper and have better terms. Students need to live like students while they're in school so that they don't have to live like students after they graduate.
All right. Mark Kantrowitz is with FinAid.org. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
So if you can't make a mortgage payment, do you max out your credit cards or drop health insurance?
When my son's playing football, my mind is always thinking, oh my God, please don't get hurt.
The tough choices facing today's middle class. And Chris Farrell tells us that rumors of a middle class demise are greatly exaggerated. You're listening to Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. This week, banking giant Capital One cut its profit forecast by 20%, and it's blaming you. The company's customers are behind on credit card bills and home equity loans. But how can anyone be surprised by this? For years, the American middle class has used plastic as an extra source of income. Yes, they are robbing Peter to pay Paul. But as Jeremy Hobson reports, Paul is now knocking on the door.
This is happening all across the country. Middle class families facing financial nightmares.
I am a divorced female, 48 years old. I have no savings, no retirement, so I'm living paycheck to paycheck.
Kathy Busby lives in Denver. She got an adjustable rate mortgage a couple years ago, figuring she would refinance out of it before the rate went up. But she couldn't. Foreclosures up and down her block caused a drop in property values, and now she's stuck with mortgage payments that keep rising, and that's creating a domino effect.
A lot of my bills are on hold. Somebody gets paid this month, and next month they don't get paid, and somebody else gets paid.
My name is Ellen Lindsay, and I live in Urbana, Illinois, and we owe lots of money to lots of people.
Lindsay works as a secretary. Her husband is in manufacturing. They make about 60 grand a year between them, and their credit card debt is astronomical.
It's probably close to 35,000.
Lindsay says much of the debt was incurred right after her son was born. He has Down syndrome and had to spend months in the hospital. Since then, missed credit card payments have pushed the interest rate on some of that debt as high as 28%.
We have no money because we have these bills. Some of the bills we incurred, you know, just for playthings. And some of it was absolutely needed. There was no question. There was credit on the credit cards, and we had to use it.
My name is Adrian. I've been the sole source of income for my family.
Adrian lives here in Washington, D.C. Her husband lost his job and hasn't worked in several months. Like many of the people I spoke with, Adrian was hesitant to talk about her problems in public. She asked that we not use her last name to protect her two teenage children.
I would hate for them to have some stigma attached to them, some teasing that results from, "Ooh, I didn't know you all were in that situation."
Adrian earns about $50,000 a year for a family of four in a major city. She also has Crohn's disease. Plus,
I don't have health insurance. Okay. So then that means if anything should happen to any of us, that's, you know, when my son's playing football, my mind is always thinking, oh my God, please don't get hurt.
With such a tight financial squeeze, you might think Adrian would also have huge credit card debt. Amazingly, that's not the case.
If I can't pay for it by way of cash, then we don't need to have it.
That's almost an un-American philosophy at this point.
It probably is.
Did you ever think that you would be in this situation?
No, I did not. Because as a child, I didn't know what it meant to have to worry about bills being paid or any of that. But in my adult years, it's a part of my reality.
Same goes for about a third of American families making between $35,000 and $75,000 a year, says Professor Edward Wolfe at New York University. They face serious financial troubles, and they don't want to admit it.
It's kind of an embarrassing situation for a lot of these families. They're in the middle class, they consider themselves middle class, and middle class families aren't supposed to have these problems.
That denial, he says, is leading to an over-reliance on credit.
They have to keep borrowing just to maintain their normal consumption standard.
So, what do the three women we've met plan to do about their situations? Well, Kathy Busby in Denver got a cheaper cell phone plan and dropped cable altogether. And she's making sure to make her minimum credit card payment every month.
It's $15. That's the one thing that I can pay. My car note is actually $355 a month. So that has to wait. $15 I can pay. You know, that's the compromise that in my mind that I've made.
Ellen Lindsay in Illinois is thinking about bankruptcy, but she's desperately trying to avoid it.
If my husband and I have to do without something or make do with what we've got, that's fine as long as we have a house and the baby's fed.
And for Adrian here in Washington, D.C., scrupulous budgeting is getting her by for now as she waits for her husband to find a job.
And the goal is not to dig a hole so deep that we can't get out of.
In Washington, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace Money.
All right, our economics editor, Chris Farrell, is here for the audio op-ed we call The Straight Story. And, you know, Chris, as we just heard, a lot of middle-class folks are feeling really squeezed.
Yeah.
Give us the big picture here. Is the middle class falling behind?
You know, Tess, it really feels that way. And the people you've been talking to, that's the message that they're giving.
Yeah.
But I have to say, when I hear this campaign rhetoric like the middle class is dying, or Lou Dobbs saying there's a war on the middle class, I say, get a grip. You know, the middle class is earning more than three decades ago. We're wealthier, and we own bigger houses. And by the way, they're stuffed with everything from central air to iPods.
Yeah, but Chris, we're also spending a whole lot more on things like healthcare.
Well, that's right, and on student loans. And as you know, we can't seem to save enough for retirement.
Right.
So here's the straight story. The American middle class isn't in decline, but its future is threatened by rising inequality between it and the wealthy. And we should do something about that now.
Well, let me ask you a question that we're really trying to get at throughout the show today, which is, how do you define the middle class?
I define it two ways. One is your classic income way. It's somewhere between $30,000 and $100,000.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's some parts of the country, $30,000 is not going to go very far.
Sure.
But there's another part of the middle class that I think is more important. And it's where I think the middle class has been invigorated. And it's this massive wave of immigration that we've had for the past two decades. Because being middle class is also having expectations, expectations that your children are going to do better. And we've had immigrants coming here, and they've been creating a better life for their children. And their children are in college. Just go to any college campus today.
But those opportunities aren't going to be there if you don't have the money to take advantage of them. And, you know, a lot of the data that we see says that over the last three decades or so, there's been a real stagnation when it comes to wages in the middle class.
You know, the data that I've looked at says, look, there have been improvements. Our economy has grown. It's not rip-roaring, though. I think the real improvements have come on the consumption side of our lives,
mm-hmm.
that we can buy a lot more stuff cheaper.
On credit.
I knew you were going to raise that issue because this is important.
Yeah.
On the one hand, while I reject that, you know, people are just all going to declare bankruptcy and we're carrying too much debt, there is something going on right now between home mortgages, credit card debt, where I do think the middle class is saying, we got to slow down here. So for the next several years, this consumer retrenchment, absolutely expect it to happen.
We talked a little bit about how you define the middle class. And,
yeah.
and I want to ask you whether you think people at this point really can afford a middle class lifestyle, a home, a vacation, a college education for the kids.
You know, I think right now, most people can afford those things. The real worry is, will their children be able to afford it? In our economy, it's always been a rising tide lifts all boats. What I'm really afraid of, a rising tide is only going to lift a few yachts.
Well, what policies do you think we need to put in place to keep lifting that tide of all boats?
The most important to me right now, universal health care and education. We've turned to our students and our parents and had them borrow too much. So we need to change the way our upper education system is working. And I would, with no tolerance whatsoever, dig deep into our inner cities, and those schools need to be improved.
All right. Chris Farrell for president. Thanks, Chris.
Thank you. And if I'm offered, I'll take the job.
Earlier in the show, we mentioned the median household income, $48,200. Well, it just so happens that the mid-range salary of a plumber is right around 48 grand. So on this week's A Day in the Work Life, we meet someone who is working his way toward becoming the very definition of a middle-class guy.
My name is Ryan Eldridge. I'm an apprentice for plumbing for the Local 78. I come to work now from 7 o'clock to 3:30, and then I'll have to go directly home, take a shower, and go to school two nights a week, 3 hours of class. It's a five-year program. I'm going to learn the ins and the outs of anything I could possibly learn in plumbing. I'm getting a lot of experience because I'm actually working at a hospital where everything is very precise, so I'm learning the correct way to do the things that I'm doing now right off the bat, which is really exciting for me. Never did any plumbing work before. I was actually in sales. Actually, I really wanted a career change. I wanted to just wake up in the morning, go to work, because before I was strictly working on commission. And I found myself working in nights when I really didn't want to work in the night. I would rather just be at home with the family. I don't know of too many other fields that you can just walk in and get a job. I walked in, I did my paperwork with the local 78. The following morning, I came to this particular job site and I knocked on some of the trailers because you have to get sponsored. As soon as you get sponsored by a company, then you go to work. And the following week, I had a paycheck. You get paid all the way through the apprenticeship. It's $12.40. Understood that I will be getting health benefits, that I possibly I'll be getting a 401k. There's just a lot of good incentives, and when work slows down on one job site, they can actually find you work at another job site, which is very beneficial. The first 2 weeks, to be honest with you, I was just exhausted. The up and the down, there's a lot of, you have to squat quite a bit, and up and down ladders, and up and down stairs, actually. This is a 9-story building. It can be pretty tiring, but by the end of the day, I feel very accomplished. It's always changing. There's always something different. So they don't say, okay, come over here, work on this particular project, and you're there all day long with the same routine. It's really pretty exciting here because there's so much change. I've learned how to run pipes. I've learned how to run tests. I've learned how to solder pipes together, one to another. You really have to have a head on your shoulders to do this type of work. So for people that think that all plumbers are dumb, they're absolutely wrong.
A Day in the Work Life was reported by Nancy Fargali.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrive and Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
This week, the Internal Revenue Service got an earful from the nation's taxpayer advocate. The most interesting recommendation? Apology payments, that's what she called them, of up to $1,000 if the IRS mishandles a case. Don't hold your breath for that one. But taxes are certainly an appropriate topic for a show about the middle class. Have you ever heard politicians talk about taxes without mentioning the middle class? Well, we wondered whether all those targeted breaks are working. And Scott Hodge of the Tax Foundation, do you think they are?
Over the last couple of years, we've tried to target the middle class with various sorts of tax deductions, like the $1,000 child tax credit. And what we've done as a result is knocked millions of low to modest income people off the tax rolls. And what that's done is it's put greater stress on these top 20% of taxpayers, those earning roughly over $80,000 a year, pay about 85% of all the income taxes in America today.
When we look at tax breaks talked about as being targeted to the middle class, you know, you think of the mortgage interest deduction, the child deduction. Do those tax breaks actually help what we think of as the middle class?
The vast majority of the benefits from things like the state and local tax deduction, the mortgage interest deduction, go to folks earning well over $100,000 a year. But the benefits of those kinds of tax breaks don't generally tend to go down the income scale. Many people who are low or modest income don't own their homes. Or if they are, they're retirees who own their homes outright and wouldn't be eligible for those deductions. Now, things like the child credit can measurably help low to modest income families because of the value of that $1,000 per child tax credit.
Tax policy-wise, what do you think would really help the middle class?
I think there are a couple ways in which you can truly benefit working families. One, obviously, you can cut their personal income tax rates. That's the most direct route. But there are other ways in which you can benefit them as well. The typical American pays someone else to do their taxes because they either feel it's too complicated or they're afraid of making a mistake. It's adding stress on people who don't need that extra stress, and it's time for fundamental reform. And I'm surprised that all these presidential candidates, not one of them is really talking about fundamental tax reform in a way that I think is realistic.
Scott Hodge is with the Nonprofit Tax Foundation. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Got a money question? Well, now is the time when it gets answered by our own economics editor, Chris Farrell. And Chris, of course, this week we're taking a special look at the middle class, who they are, what kind of problems they face. First up this week is Dee from Clifton, New Jersey. And Dee, before we get to your question, would you consider yourself part of the middle class?
If I was middle class, then I think the middle class is in big trouble.
Well, tell us a little bit about your situation.
My husband and I are both working full time, and we are pretty much just barely getting by. We make about $65,000 a year. We have really good jobs, and since we moved from Ohio to New Jersey last year, the amount of money coming in kind of equals the amount of money going out right now. $65,000 really does not cut it here.
Chris, I would say this certainly does sound like a definition of middle class having trouble making ends meet.
Absolutely. And it also emphasizes the point of what part of the country are you living in. As you mentioned, $65,000 in Ohio is a very different sum of money than $65,000 in Clifton, New Jersey.
So what can we help you with today then?
Well, my main question was, how do we pay down our debt and actually get health insurance for my entire family, not just my daughter? And I'll also put some money aside for retirement and some type of savings, which we don't have right now.
Do you have credit card debt?
We just consolidated all our debt to one card, roughly about $15,000 in credit card debt.
All right, Chris, first steps?
My main reaction is there's so many things you want to do, say, for your daughter, or get yourself out of debt. Two things that I'd focus on. One is paying down the credit card debt, because every time you pay down that credit card debt, you increase your savings. The second focus, and this is an easy thing for me to say, it is hard to do. Over the next year or two, because you're in New Jersey and you're in the market that you're in, you know, thinking about, do you search for a job that will offer your family health insurance? That actually becomes a priority. There are part-time jobs like Starbucks and Whole Foods and some other companies that have opened up their health insurance plan to part-time workers. And then try and relax on some of the other things, because otherwise the stress can become overwhelming.
Dee, so neither of your jobs offers any sort of health insurance?
No, unfortunately not. Even if our companies offered the health insurance, we wouldn't be able to afford them here.
Right. But it is, from a personal finance point of view, that would be my number one priority.
Okay. That's something to look into.
All right. Well, best of luck to you, Dee.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for the call.
No problem.
Well, Chris, as I was saying, I mean, this really just encapsulates the problem that you hear so much with the middle class. And here we're talking to a family that makes $65,000. On its face, you think, well, $65,000, a family of three can live on that. But it really does depend on your individual circumstance.
Right.
Well, we hope this segment and the rest of the show can help everyone in the middle class, and we'd love to hear if it does. Send us a note at our website. It's marketplace.org. Look for the Getting Personal button, or give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. And stay tuned for more Getting Personal later in the show. Coming up, is the middle class of today any different from 20 years ago?
A generation ago, one paycheck would buy housing, health insurance, and still have 50% left over to spend on all the discretionary expenses.
We continue our look at the fate of the middle class. You're listening to Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. When you think of the American dream, you probably think of people starting with nothing and working their way to a better life. That kind of social mobility has been a hallmark of progress in this country. But not all dreams are created equal. Minority families actually have a tougher time achieving middle-class status. And even when they do, the children of minorities are much less likely to hang on to that status than children in white families. Stacey Vanek-Smith takes a look at some of the hurdles minorities face in joining middle-class America.
For generations, Americans have prided themselves on the idea that in this country, there is opportunity available to anyone who is willing to work hard. Sure, we may be a little skeptical of this, but there's no denying it's a huge part of American identity and deeply embedded in the culture.
I believe in America. America has made my fortune.
I like to be in America. Oh.
okay by me in America.
You had all that here. Why would you want to go back to Puerto Rico?
It's so good here.
It's so good there. We had nothing.
Ah, we still have nothing. Only more expensive.
We're moving on now.
You kids of the day, you think the world owes you a living?
Oh, now wait a minute.
And you know something? You may be right.
Mark Morial is CEO of the National Urban League, an African American advocacy group. He says the American dream is alive and well and still defines the aspirations of many U.S. families.
Usually it means home ownership. Usually it means some level of family income that gives them a chance to have a decent lifestyle.
But the American dream may not be equally available to everyone. Last year, minorities' incomes remained flat, while white Americans saw incomes jump more than 1%, according to the U.S. Census Bureau. And a study from the Brookings Institution found that minority families have a harder time holding on to the income status they achieve.
Not all children are benefiting equally from the American dream.
Study author Julia Isaac says among middle-income families, 2 out of 3 white children earned more than their parents, and only 1 out of 3 black children did. She said she was shocked by the findings, and it's definitely a problem this country needs to address.
We do find that both income and race of your parents affects where you end up. If your parents were poor, or if your parents are African-American, at any income level, you, on average, don't rise as high on the income ladder as white children and as children from higher income backgrounds.
So why is it harder for minority kids to reach the same status as their parents? The job market is a big part of the problem, says the Urban League's Mark Morial.
The issue is not just a job. It's a good job with good pay that provides them with the benefits they need for themselves and their families. And we've seen that as a continuing post 9/11 issue, because any recovery which has taken place has been somewhat jobless, or it's been a recovery where people have transitioned to lower paying jobs with fewer benefits.
Nora Vargas agrees. She directs the Latino Issues Forum. She says in addition to the decline in job quality, fewer employers are offering health care. She says this creates 2 major problems. It tends to hurt productivity because workers can't afford preventative care. And if families buy their own health care, she says, it just makes it that much harder to invest in things like education.
It is becoming much more difficult to be able to go to a school. Most of us who reach that middle class dream are folks who have the opportunities to get an education and use that education to be able to succeed. And so without access to quality education, you can't compete.
Another major hurdle minority families are facing, the housing crisis. The National Urban League's Mark Morial says many middle-income minorities are taking a huge hit.
The threat of foreclosure and a subprime housing crisis threatens to take many people who had achieved or who were on their way to achieving middle-class status and taking them back 2 or 3 notches.
Morial says if the government doesn't step in, many hardworking minorities will see their credit tank, and that will make it much harder for families to take out other kinds of loans, like student loans and car loans. Nora Vargas agrees. She says this is a crucial moment for U.S. minorities, and if action isn't taken soon, the economic gap will widen.
The American dream is harder to achieve, and it seems that there is a direct link to your background and your heritage as to whether or not to be able to have access to it.
Vargas says 2008 is shaping up to be a tough year for minority families, but she says because this is an election year, she's optimistic that many of these issues will be addressed by the presidential candidates. In Los Angeles, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement. And by Reuters, delivering news and information that reaches over 1 billion people every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters.
Here's a benchmark you'll often hear in discussions about the middle class, and Stacey's piece got at this a bit. Are we collectively better off than our parents, or are we largely burdened by the so-called middle class squeeze? For some answers, we turn to Elizabeth Warren, author of The Two-Income Trap, Why Middle-Class Mothers and Fathers Are Going Broke, and Greg Easterbrook. He's the author of The Progress Paradox, How Life Gets Better While People Feel Worse. And let's start, as we've been doing throughout the show, by getting your parameters for the middle class. Elizabeth, who do you define as the middle class?
It's all those people who declare themselves middle class, and that means it goes from some pretty low incomes to some pretty high incomes. And I think that's important. A lot of people want to bound it at around $20,000, $25,000 a year up to about $100,000 a year. But I really do think it's a lot more about enduring criteria. You know, a third grade teacher who gets laid off may not have any income right now, but I would still regard her as middle class.
All right, Greg, how would you define it, either with a number or a description?
I would be more simplistic and just say it's people who are neither rich nor poor. A lot of it's sociological, but I would say education probably cuts more across it than any other single defining factor for the middle class. Education, in a lot of cases, just means a high school diploma. But everybody who's in the middle class now in the United States, European Union, and Japan is a product of a successful educational system and believes in education as a life goal. And you couldn't say that of the average person 100 years ago.
Let me address a phrase that we've been hearing more and more recently, especially from the presidential campaign trail, which is this notion of a middle class crunch. Elizabeth, are families today struggling more than their counterparts did a generation ago?
Yes, they are. A generation ago, one paycheck would buy housing, health insurance, pay taxes, transportation, and still have 50% left over to spend on all the discretionary expenses. Today, it takes two-thirds of two paychecks to buy those same housing, health insurance, transportation, taxes, and of course now childcare is thrown in. I think families are under a lot more squeeze than they were just a generation ago.
Greg, on the other hand, you've written that Americans are better off today than ever before. Do you believe there is a middle-class crunch?
Liz is certainly right that the paycheck stress is on everybody's mind, but you can't factor out of the equation that what that money is buying is a higher quality of life. And the health care that Liz mentioned, health care spending is a big concern, but health outcomes are also so much better today. The question that I would ask would be, would you say, you know, I don't want to live in 2008. I'd rather live in 1958 when women, for intents and purposes, weren't allowed to work out of the home. If you're willing to trade the present for some year of the past, then you have a fundamental complaint. If you're not, then what we're arguing is the reforms necessary to improve the present.
Well, I don't get why you don't have a complaint. We have 47 million people without health insurance. Half of all Americans haven't saved a single dollar toward their pension. I just think it misframes the problem to say, do you want to live in 1958? The question is, are families today under a financial crunch? Are they in a squeeze? And the answer is yes, they are.
I wonder if this gets to the question of what are the things that you should expect to have if you are in the middle class? Is it a house? Is it two cars? At what point do we say, okay, there is a baseline for what your life is like when you are in the middle class?
Well, I don't think it's so much material possessions, but your position in life. I think the reason why people feel these issues so keenly now is that we've equated reaching middle class existence with achieving security. We now have a larger middle class than we've ever had before, but we have far less security than before in the sense that you've reached the middle class and now everything is fine does not exist for most people and doesn't even exist for a lot of upper middle class people. And that's why I think we feel so keenly the faults in the current system, even when objectively almost all trends are positive.
Let me ask you then how it is that, you know, people who make $100,000, even $150,000, up to $200,000 will still classify themselves as the middle class.
You bet. And that's partly because those folks are trying to replicate what their parents had. And at $100,000, at $150,000 in many metropolitan areas in America today, you simply can't do that. Think about this. A generation ago, in early 1970s, the average one-income family was putting away 11% of their take-home pay in savings. For the last 5 years, families have been going negative. They borrowed more than they've spent, and they have zero savings. They can't do it.
And you wanted to respond to something that Elizabeth said?
Liz said that people are struggling just to replicate what their parents had. Statistically, they're not. They're struggling to live at a significantly better level than their parents did. And I'm glad. I think everybody should do that. But preponderance of people who go to grad school, who have two computers, one car per person, they're trying to live at a better level than their parents did. No wonder it's stressful.
But the point is, what does it take to launch a child into the middle class today? In the 1950s, shoot, in the 1970s, you look at the survey data, and about 85% of families said, a high school diploma and a willingness to work hard will give my child a place in the middle class. You reach the year 2008, and the overwhelming majority of Americans say it takes a college diploma just to have a chance to make it into the middle class. Parents today say it takes 2 years of preschool to get a child ready to go to school. That's 6 years of additional education. It now takes a lot more money to launch a middle-class child than it did a generation ago.
Well, there isn't any doubt that stress on the middle class constantly rises and it takes more money to achieve things. But remember, your outcome is also better. Let's not lose sight of that. Families today that aspire to put their children into white-collar positions are aspiring to a fundamentally better life. You could still have the lifestyle of the 50s at a much lower price, but we would all say it's not sufficient.
Greg Easterbrook is a fellow at the Brookings Institution and author of The Progress Paradox. Elizabeth Warren teaches law at Harvard University and is the author of The Two-Income Trap. Thank you both for helping us out today.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. We're back again with Getting Personal. And as always, I'm joined by Chris Farrell, our personal finance expert. And Chris, our next question comes in via email. Fred from Burnt Hills, New York, writes in that he's a 65-year-old retired educator, and with some assistance from an investment company, he's always managed his own portfolio. But now this company is advising him to turn over his portfolio to them to manage for, wait for it, a 1% fee. They claim it's going to better protect his investments against any sort of market crash. So is this a good idea? What should he do? 1% doesn't seem too bad.
You know, 1% is industry average at this point. But I have really a couple questions about this. You know, he's been managing his own money. So let's look at some other alternatives. I was looking at some of those target funds.
Mm-hmm. Where it's based on your age and where you are in your investing timeline.
Exactly. Well, there are target funds and lifestyle funds out now for the retiree when you're in retirement. The fees are pretty low. And then there's this whole new slew of mutual funds being created by Fidelity and Vanguard and T. Rowe Price, these sort of income distribution funds. And I think these are kind of the real alternatives to this kind of turning your money over to a money management firm and saying, manage my money for a 1% fee. Because my question is, a lot of money management firms don't do that well. Are they really going to earn their 1%? Are they better than some of these mutual fund offerings? So this is actually a much bigger question than I can answer. But here's my sort of primary point. He's 65. He's been managing his own money. What I'd be asking myself is, how can I put this on as automatic pilot as possible as I get older and maybe I'm not going to be as engaged in the market? Do I want to turn this money over to this firm, or are there other alternatives that may be better for me? And I think there may be some better alternatives.
All right. Well, if you're having problems making a decision, do give us a call. We'll become your decider. Our phone number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. And our next caller is Melissa from Lincoln, Nebraska. Hi, Melissa.
Hi there.
Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I work with the electric utility provider here in Lincoln and have recently had my car die in a metal heap on the side of the road.
Uh-oh, are you sure you're calling the right program?
Basically.
You want to talk to those car guys?
Yeah, I know. I the car advice would be lost on me. I'm hoping the financial advice will take a little better and that I can move forward with that.
All right, so I assume that you're probably calling then about a car loan.
In fact, that's why I went to my banker. I was thinking about a car loan, and once I was in the office, he talked to me about refinancing my home in order to pay for a vehicle. So I've always thought of my home equity as something that was there for when my basement floods or if a huge branch from the oak trees in our backyard comes crashing through the roof, that sort of stuff. Never had really thought of this as something that I would use for purchases outside of the home.
Well, Chris, I don't know about you, but my first reaction is, who's this banker?
Good for the banker. Not good for you.
Yeah.
You are absolutely right. There's just a couple ways to think about this. I mean, part of it is just think of it from a risk management point of view. If for some reason you got into financial trouble and you have a home mortgage and you have a car loan, you can walk away from the car loan. But where a lot of people today are getting into financial trouble when we're hearing about these mortgages, what happened is a lot of them consolidated their loans and they took their auto loans and their credit cards and they put it on their home. And all of a sudden they're carrying too much mortgage and the value of the home has declined and they're in a real financial squeeze and they can't walk away from their credit card debt. They can't walk away from their car loans because it's wrapped into their mortgage.
Chris, this is where we've heard over the last several years about people literally using their homes as ATM machines.
Yeah, and it's just a bad idea.
Okay, I had thought so. If there was a great deal to be had there, I didn't want to miss out on it.
Here's the selling routine. It's going to be a great deal because you'll get a lower interest rate, which you will, and you'll get a tax-deductible interest rate. Both are true, but it's not good personal finance. So even though you would get a lower rate if you pursued this strategy, it's not a sensible route to pursue.
Okay.
So are you going to go get that car loan?
I think I'm going to go to a different bank and I think I'm going to redirect to a car loan. Yeah.
There you go. There you go.
Okay. Sounds good to me.
Have fun car shopping.
Well, thanks.
Bye-bye.
Thanks a lot.
Bye.
All right. Well, Chris, unfortunately, that's all the time we have this week.
That's too bad. Well, it's fun as always.
But as we know, you are taking questions all throughout the week.
Yes.
Just visit our website, marketplace.org, and click on the Getting Personal link. Or you can call us at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Thanks so much, Chris.
Thanks a lot.
And that is Middle Class Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, how high oil prices are affecting more than your gas tank.
We're all connected in every way, and sadly, we are all connected to petroleum products.
Marketplace Money is produced by John Haas with Rico Galliano, Stephen Hoffman, James Richter, and the rest of the Marketplace staff. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
American Public Media.